Welcome to Community Matters. I'm Akeegan Boyce. In an era of streaming and AI and algorithmic discovery, sometimes we forget that there are humans behind the music. Music is one of the most human things that we do, after all. On Community Matters, we chat with artists who share their stories through the lens of their music communities, the people that have been there alongside their journeys. We hope it's a reminder of just how important people are to the music that we love. Today I'm speaking with Haley Four. Hey, Haley.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, I'm doing all right. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine. Can you hear me?
I can.
Amazing. Haley is a composer and singer-songwriter based in Chicago. You may know her as Circuit Does You or as the enigmatic Jackie Lynn. And if you don't, once you've heard her sing, you won't forget. Her voice has a lovely, haunting timbre that glides between four octaves. And she's exceptional at relating her personal experience to the human condition at large, an ability that's earned her a cover on Wire magazine and much critical acclaim for her records. She and I discussed how her early music communities in Bloomington and Chicago helped to form her identity as an artist, and how that identity continues to evolve amidst her two projects. We also got a little existential, examining the disparity between art and capitalism, and how this COVID moment is elucidating the incongruity between the two, where streaming revenue is there, but not necessarily going to the right places. But the silver lining is that it's inspired innovation for alternative support structures that have allowed Haley to connect with some benevolent strangers. There is hope. And we started with my first encounter with Haley's music.
I always like to tell, you know, people how I first encountered their music because I, you know, I find it interesting anyways. But I saw Circuit to You play at a Basilica Soundscape back in 2015. And, you know, it was my first time in that place. I think you were playing a relatively early show, and your song Fantasize the Scene came on. And yeah, it was like, you know, super haunting being in this old basilica, and it was, you know, kind of a magical moment. And, you know, I've been a fan ever since.
Oh, well, thank you for being there. That was one of the earlier reiterations of being like a band, a Circuit Does You. And that was a fantastic time in my life. We, like those four people and I, traveled America, and I think we each made maybe like $300 after a month of touring, and we did not give a shit. We had such a good time. At that time in our lives, like, we all just had the capacity to kind of revel in the chaos. To me, that time in my life just feels like beautiful chaos. I'm glad you were able to capture part of it.
Me too. Maybe that's a good segue. You know, we'd love to hear, you know, kind of your story, you know, your first encounters with, you know, music and the idea of, oh yeah, this is what I want to do. And then, you know, your early music communities and, you know, I guess how they evolved along the way.
Certainly. For me, it's a really convoluted path. Going all the way back to the very, very beginning, Lafayette, Indiana, my hometown, I remember maybe my first musical experience was being in first grade and singing, trying out for this choir and singing onto a cassette. I just liked the way it felt. And general music and these free public programs are exclusively the only way that I got an education in vocals, playing piano, these really sort of rudimentary ideas of what music could be as a child. It wasn't until I was maybe 17 that I decided to play in public first, for the first time in my life. And my cousin was my roommate, and he was hosting a open mic at a cafe. Or it was actually at a local barbecue joint. And I arrived with a tom and a keyboard, and I sang. And the owner, within a few minutes of my performance, stopped me and took the microphone, and he said, "We need a real musician up here. This is not real music." It's important for me to say that, because if I would have listened to that person, I wouldn't be here today. most great art that resonates in the world was made in poverty or was completely dismissed by the world that it was born in. So if you're an artist out there making something and you feel you're in the dark, it's really like on the scale of everything. It's such a blip, and that your art will live on forever and it's gonna make waves. And I don't know, music is the healing force of the universe, 100%. And shift came like a tidal wave, closest to the sun you've been, 1,000 miles away. There you'll see the clouds and call out the rain. The world wants an oath, but all you can see. There was a gay club called Zoolagers, and I was underage, but it sort of forced me into the weirdos of the people who weren't really connecting or accepted in my community. And in that pocket, I was able to listen to touring bands, listen to punk music for the first time, that sort of thing. And it was really, really nutritious for me. So that place and getting to that place of empathy and understanding, like, you can do things and that people aren't going to immediately gravitate toward, but it still carries weight and it carries currency. It's something that I think has carried me up to today. I went to school in Bloomington, Indiana, and that's really where the underground DIY scene sort of accepted me. And that's when I really got involved in community for the first time, I think. I can't even go on to explain how important DIY scenes are, especially in the Midwest. I've booked tours just based off of word of mouth, you know, before iPhones, using record forums and even the local record shop and posting emails and phone numbers of people, bands in the area. I moved here to Chicago in 2012. I knew some people in Chicago already just from sort of playing in the tri-state area of Indiana, Ohio, and Illinois. But to be quite frank, moving to the city, it took some time, and it took maybe like a year and a half or so of really just sort of breaking into the scene. I just went to every show. Like, I went to the jazz shows, I went to the punk shows, I went to the DIY spaces, and you just meet people and you say, do you want to jam? And some don't, some do. And now it's like 10 years later, and a lot of those people are on my records and I'm on their records, and it's wild. Once the rain has washed away every footprint you have made, once the wind has blown through every word it spoke, every hidden truth. Chicago has one of the most supportive and thriving music communities in the world. I know people that have never toured and they have such a fulfilling existence as an artist here. There's so many venues, there's so many genres. Also, it's not very competitive. It's interesting. I mean, can I talk about what my issue is with the DIY community scene?
Totally. Absolutely. Feel free.
Yeah. It's just a double-edged sword for me because it's something that I identify with, but I don't really work in those environments anymore. And it's something that I've really had to like talk with myself about, because I really think some of the best, most radical art I've ever seen has been in the basement of someone's house. You know, like, as much as I love it, I do. What I found in Chicago, at least, it was sort of like a closed circle. I'm not saying it's exclusive because anyone can go there, but it is a little ageist, or the demographic is really similar in regards to age. You know, it's like you're in your 20s to 30s. And it bothered me just because I want to reach people of all minds and learn from them. And so because of that, I really branched out to try and play any sort of scenario I can. So I play the museums and I play the tall stages, but then I also really try to play the living room shows too.
Community is integral to the DIY world, especially for someone with such an inclusive approach who seeks to invite all kinds of people to her music. So in the absence of live music, forever the ground zero of music community, how have things changed? You know, how do you feel about live streaming and all these different companies that are starting to pivot or include some live streaming option? And have you utilized that at all? Have you found that to be effective? And if not live streaming, particularly like Twitch, you know, has that been something that you've started to leverage or seen other people, you know, using successfully? And then a part two to that question, like, do you think there's a viable future for those once, you know, live music does come back, whenever that is?
I have been very reticent to join the live streaming quarantine concert community in that initially I felt that it did a disservice to my artistry because I've worked so far to this point, especially when it comes to live music. I think I'm really good at it and I don't think I'm very good at Wi-Fi connection. I hate the lack of control. I really dislike it. However, I reached a point where I was completely starved, not only of the audience interaction, like I need that serotonin, like I need to sing and I need someone's body to resonate from it. I haven't personally done a Twitch. Watching a Twitch show, for instance, I watched a couple ESS quarantine concert series, and I also watched Bang on a Can with Terry Riley, did a really amazing performance. And I have to say that I like them each for different reasons. The Terry Riley one, I just loved. I was just really fulfilled by his performance. And with the Twitch more, you know, relaxed sort of ESS concert, I really love the comment section.
Yeah.
And just like hearing how everyone's doing and having a drink, and there's something really ritualistic to it. It was almost like, I was raised Catholic and my mother watches Mass on TV sometimes late at night, and I'm non-practicing, but I just felt it reminded me of that scene. This is my Mass and my religion. And when it comes to this corporate sort of like, I do think people are racing to like find the platform and to monetize. It's a tough conversation because I morally do not feel capitalism and art should be intertwined. And while I'm playing on that field, I have never made music for capital gain. So as an artist who has no government funding, I didn't qualify for any unemployment. I'm completely at the behest of like benevolent strangers, and it's working out. And I don't know how or why, but I don't know. It bothers me. I think anything on the internet is filled with data optics that people get sidelined by and companies get interested in, and it just gets in the way of like the one-to-one relationship that we're missing right now from live music.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I do agree, you know, capitalism and art are pretty at odds. Like it's really difficult to make them work together. But of course, it's also difficult to remove ourselves from a capital society that, you know, requires us to make a living and, you know, eat, buy food, things like that. So given that we are in that reality, what needs to change in the industry? I mean, this moment has elucidated even more so, you know, the inequity in the industry and like the inadequate streaming rates and those payouts and like how integral live music is to artists' well-being. From a financial perspective alone. And if you could create the solution, what would it look like?
Right. It's tough. And I think that my stance has a real issue in practice, like in principle, you know, like I think that art supersedes the value of a dollar. And so because of that, like I don't think about money when I'm making things. However, it could also be argued that By not focusing on, I mean, it just comes down to devaluation. Like if I don't charge money for my art,
right.
It is argued that it will eventually be worth no money. And so I think that this sort of like restructurization, that's not a word, restructuring, it's already happening in a way. Like, we're in this era where, I mean, GoFundMes break my heart, but you know, the way people are right now sort of being signaled to give what you can and give from your heart, I think that's needs to be implemented in a more like social service sort of way. Like I said, I really think that these incubators for art, especially community-driven ones, whether it be in someone's basement or in a church or on a stage, like, I really think the government should be funding them, and I think that it should come out of taxpayer money. I do. And it would solve a lot of problems. For instance, in France, I know they have a system in which artists make a salary. Like, they are paid by the government a working salary. I'm talking between $40,000 and $55,000 a year.
Wow.
Now, they have things that they have to agree to do, such as like community outreach and playing a certain amount of shows a year. And so they have to prove their activity in this agreement. But I just see things thriving for longer than 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years even. And when you think of longevity, as detrimental and as worried as I am about the closing of venues that I've played in for the last 5, 10 years and not being able to work with a promoter who's really my friend because they've had to get another job, it's like, remember this time and remember what got others out of it. And I guess it's not really a clear answer, but I just think funding, man. People, there's a lot of money out there. There's a lot of money out there. It's just
It's not going to. It's not split fairly, and that's, you know, true, both inside and outside of music, of course.
Like, the public library saves so many lives here in the city, and I love it. And if we had like a public library of music, like just the same principle for oral history as written history, you know, I think that would give so much to humanity, really.
Totally. And I think there's like an educational component here as well. I think there are people, like, now that, you know, the streaming model is like, that's the norm. Like, if, you know, when people know that they can pay $10 a month for every song like ever made in, you know, history of humanity, I mean, that's an exaggeration, but not too far off. And for all intents and purposes. And like, if that's the model, like, people aren't going to go out of their way to try to learn that, oh yeah, artists are actually only making, you know, 0.04 cents per stream, and that, you know, it's like 300 streams in order to make a dollar, which is insane. There's no other way to consume music. I mean, you can like go to Bandcamp and you can order, but, you know, how many people really use Bandcamp who aren't already, you know, plugged into music and somehow.
I think that information is spreading, and I think talking about it is important and raising visibility on this issue, because it is a huge issue, and it's totally the main reason why the industry, I mean, pre-COVID, of course, why the industry is tanking. However, I also feel like as an artist, like me personally, my psyche as an artist, I have had that conversation for years with myself, and it's toxic. At what point am I ingesting the poison and thinking of my own shit as streams? But I guess my other main concern is, like, there's a byproduct of shame, I feel like, for consumers. And I worry about it because I'm so in control of how my music sounds that to control the way it's consumed feels a little fascist to me. And I don't think that, I think streaming is an incredible way to spread music. The payout is the only issue here.
Right.
Well, there's a couple issues, but the payout, I guess, is the main civil unrest. Like, it's just not compliant to equality at all.
Right.
But humans are also going to do whatever is the most convenient. And but I mean, I also feel like convenience is such a short-term feeling, and that when you're clipping corners, like in 5 years, you know, me for instance, the dawning of Netflix, like, I used to have Criterion Collection DVDs, Blu-rays, and the dawn of Netflix, and it was such a slow stripping of, I don't know, like, real valuable visual art in my life, but I didn't even notice until today, you know, or last night, going through the shitty Netflix, and I'm like, this used to be so nutritious. This used to be such a awesome thing I would do, and now it's just feels like overnight, but it wasn't. It was just like 5 years of clipping down all the beautiful, delicious, nutritious visual art I used to have in my life.
Yeah.
And I think people will wake up one day, hopefully, with music in the same way.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's an energy around it that's pushing it forward in the right direction. I think people are learning more, becoming more aware, which is great. Little by little, of course, it'll happen more slowly than it should. But things like Netflix, I read this really, really fascinating article. Like, it was about platform capitalism and how platforms abstract context away from the art itself. It's like so much so that we're getting to the point where we're going to say, I'm going to watch Netflix. I'm going to listen to Spotify. And like, Netflix is not something to watch. It's just a platform for art. And Spotify is not something to listen to. It's a platform for art. And like, how much damage, it's not something I noticed I was doing or other people were doing until I read this. It's like, how much damage are we doing by abstracting this to this extent that we don't even acknowledge the art? At this point, you know, art doesn't even have, like, each piece of art doesn't have its own, you know, kind of intrinsic uniqueness. It's all grouped into just art, something you can consume.
Yeah, I feel like that begs the question. I think that this issue has been chiseled away at already by capitalist industrial complex of music, like since the 60s, in which, for instance, I'm working on a new record and I was trying to research recording engineers. And there is such a lack of database of people who record music. I'm not talking producers or singer-songwriters. Like, it takes a team to make a product. Yeah. And everyone knows that, like, you just focus in on, like, the lead singer. And it takes a fucking team of 20 people to make something awesome. And so I feel like this, like, listening to Spotify, like, it's already happened in a way. But you are correct in that this takes it even a step further, which is creepy as hell.
Yeah. You mentioned you're making an album right now. I'm curious to hear more about that. Is it, you know, for Jackie Lynn? Is it Circuit DU? Is it something else?
Yeah, sure. I'm making the Circuit DU album right now, and I'm taking my time, but I hope that the sorrow eats everyone's sorrow. That's kind of where I'm going with this music, because it is so heavy, man.
That's one of the things I love about it. Yeah, I was going to ask about that, you know, because this moment definitely feels like it lends itself better to, you know, the darker sort of aesthetic of Circuit to you. So I figured that might be what you're writing.
Yeah, I mean, I've never had this problem, but I actually have like 2.5 hours of music, and I'm just trying to like really refine. And I go through days, I mean, I go through weeks where I can't, like, my psychic energy feels like it's been vampirically ripped from my brain the moment I wake up, you know, and I just can't make anything. But the days I do find inspiration, I really try to make it count. And now I'm trying to figure out just the logistics of working with people, because I've come to that point where I've realized I need the people. So I'm considering, like, how do you record an orchestra outside? Or I don't know, I'm really trying to be imaginative and positive, because I am a cynic by trade. But what can you do?
Yeah.
Greyhound 94 on wheel, not looking back anymore.
I know this has been well documented and written about, but for the sake of people listening to this, would you mind telling us, you know, a little bit about Jackie Lynn, her history, how she was born, what her state of mind is now.
So I have another project called Jackie Lynn, and she is a fictional character who lives in Chicago. Right now, I guess her location is unknown, but she takes on different roles. It's the second album. It came out in April, and it's actually a band. I'm in a band with another group of people that call themselves Bitchin' Bajas. It's Cooper Crane, Rob Fry, and Dan Quinlivan. And together we make sort of like all sorts of genres of music, but this last album I consider stadium synth, like
nice
stadium synth music. So it's to be quiet, kind of anthemic, but also introspective. So maybe like the pop music in your brain, only for your brain. And she's sort of like femme fatale country meets the open road. She is a long-haul truck driver on her latest odyssey. And artistically, I kind of made her as a trash can to throw all of the societal pressures, I feel. Like, when you decide to try and make a living off your art, there's a lot of external conversation, and some of it can be hurtful. And I chose to make this character just so that she can embody all the things that I feel like people want from me that I'm just not. And in that way, it's been really empowering. And I've found a lot of different sides of myself musically and also personally from it.
Hmm. Cool. I'm curious, how does your mindset change, you know, when you're writing for Circuit to You, which I guess presumably as yourself versus, you know, kind of writing as an alter ego, writing as Jackie Lynn? I mean, how does it feel different? How do you orient yourself from one to the other?
Well, to start with Jackie Lynn, I always start with a short story. So I actually like write out the premise and I live in it, you know, I'm workshopping a short story. And then from there I derive maybe little anecdotes of what might happen. And they're really mirroring like issues I've had in my own life, but what it lacks that I think Circuit de Zeus embodies is, I think there's a lot of mystery and there isn't much depth. I'm not trying to say it's shallow, but I don't know. Circuit de Zeus, when I'm writing that music, it's like this light bulb. It's almost like trauma. It's like stuck in me, and the only way I can resolve it is to sing about it. And so when I make a Circuit de Zeus song, there are 5 to 20 things that it's about, and I can't really explain it more than that. It's very personal. And with Jackie Lynn, it's almost just like something, it's like writing a TV show. Not to say it doesn't resonate personally or can do that for someone else, like a listener.
Right.
It's not up to me, but it's much more on the surface.
Got it. Right. So one is much more emotive and more cathartic, the other more formulaic and sort of narrative driven.
Yeah, you know, one thing about my practice is I love to read about other creators, and I read a lot of interviews and listen to a lot of podcasts. And something I realized is a lot of people who make a living off of art sort of have this performative aspect, and part of me feels like it keeps them healthy, and it keeps them maybe like there's a little invisible fence between them and the listener that no one really knows about except for the creator. And I've never really did that, and so this is sort of like an experiment, and like, well, maybe I should try and be more professional or just be like more reserved, more packaged or something, you know. I don't know, obviously
like
this, it didn't really work out for me this last time, but that's,
well,
all
that's,
right.
that's not your fault. So have you started to look ahead to, I know there's like so much uncertainty surrounding everything and everywhere, but you know, have you started to look ahead to try to plan for anything post pandemic, other in terms of like actually getting out there, playing music for people, anything like that?
I feel like the only conscious, safe way right now for me to personally perform for people is through recorded music. So I hope to do another quarantined, it's called a takeaway show, where I basically perform some new material and then let in some aspects of my life to the viewer. It's really helped me understand like there's a lot of different mediums to get the message across. So I don't know, I've written albums, I've come up with my idea of like a retrospective, I call it, my first and last art show maybe, or, you know, maybe just think of things in a more multimedia experiential way, because I do miss, I really miss connecting with the audience and the people that listen to music, trying to figure out a way, different ways to just make it authentic, really.
Do you feel like you've been able to do that at all while, you know, online, to cultivate community, to connect with, you know, the people who listen to your music? You know, have you felt that? I know you mentioned like the Twitch thing, like the chat room, of that functionality. Like, do you feel like you've been able to leverage any of that to stay in touch with your community?
Well, to be frank, I'm a very mercurial person and very emotionally sensitive. So, I mean, some days the internet can be exactly what I need to connect, and then some days it's my worst enemy, you know, where it's like a flood of information. So I pick and choose. This platform, Noon Chorus, is what I chose to use for my quarantine concert, and it was nice. It felt comfortable to me because it felt like a real place. Twitch to me feels like, I don't know, like trick-or-treating or something, where you're just like, there's so many doors to open. I enjoyed Noon Chorus because it felt private and special, but I'm a very small artist, so getting the word out, I don't have a newsletter. I'm pretty lazy when it comes to my internet self. I'm pretty focused on like making the art, but I should think about that more.
Well, I mean, I think you've got your focus in the right place with, you know, making the music. I mean, I think it's unfortunate now how much time needs to be spent on like the marketing aspect. You know, I think that's, you know, such a huge difficulty for a lot of smaller artists. I mean, you know, like the bottom 90% of artists, you know, when I said that, I mean like the 90% with the fewest amount of streams are only accounting for like 0.8% of the total streams that are happening on the platform. So it's like, you know, if you can't engage with the community there, you know, like it forces you to engage so, like to rely so much on these other social frameworks that are also, you know, kind of oppressed by algorithms. And
it's true, man. It's like we're all in Dante's Inferno and there's no way out. Like, use Twitter to like talk about Spotify.
Yeah.
Like, it is a conundrum. I really think and hope I hope that there is a vaccine for the coronavirus within the next 6 months to a year. And I also hope there's a vaccine to the music industry in which there is like a artist run. That's all it needs to be, is an artist run model to Spotify, in which we're all appropriately paid. And it's all about people actually conglomerating there and going, you know, flocking to the field or what have you. Like, we need the listeners there. Like have you heard about the Patreon model?
Sure.
Sure you have.
Yeah, yeah.
And that seems really viable for some artists of my size. I just have a moral conundrum with it, which goes back to my idea of like capitalism. And I've seen this Patreon model as being sort of amped as a sort of like socialist excursion, where you can be directly paid and you can give all of this free exclusive content. But as a creator, I just see it as like monetizing my thoughts. Like, it just gets creepier and creepier. Like, I already feel like I monetize enough of my soul, and I don't know, man, I'm a bad capitalist. I would love to give it all away for free.
You're buzzing low, below you can see the toll.
There was a benevolent stranger, you know, like you tweet about it and then some of my friends retweeted it. And this person who had never even heard my music bought 40 tickets just to give away.
Wow.
That's the kind of shit that keeps me alive.
Right.
And no one has to buy 40 tickets, but it's the same idea of like, if it's 40 cents, it really counts. And I don't know. I just think that's a big predicament with this because everyone feels like shit, the consumer and the artist.
Yeah, but I think you're right. It's like it's uplifting, you know, each other. It comes back to, you know, interdependence and how we, I mean, we can't do it ourselves.
No one's an independent artist these days. No one. Like, that was such a fucking lie of American nationalism or something. Like, to be the independent entrepreneur is such a facade that I was fed as a child, and I'm pretty upset about it. But I also want it to be known that these avenues for helping artists out, I mean, the analogous metaphor to me, it's so simple. It's like a farmer's market. There are so many fountain pops that taste like shit that will make you feel like shit, and you can have them for 99 cents at any gas station. But if you want like a $100 bottle of wine, or not that I'm a $100 bottle of wine, maybe like if you want like a $20 bottle of wine that's locally sourced and organic, you want to listen to my music, those avenues are there. You just got to get in your on your bike and maybe like ride a little farther.
And then you'll get there and you'll have a conversation, you'll meet some other people, you'll buy some, you know, fresh kale while you're there, and you have a great time.
Exactly. You'll drink it, it'll make you, get you drunk, and you'll love it.
Yeah. I mean, and you'll feel really good about yourself, and, you know, you'll pat yourself on the back for having such a good day, and you'll be thankful that this music exists.
And those gatekeepers exist. They're out there. They're like good, benevolent gatekeepers who are, you know, making sure that rain or shine, the farmer's market is there.
Exactly. Like, we're going to have this and we're going to get our food to the people.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, I've already taken an hour of your time, and I think that's a really beautiful, hopeful place to leave the conversation.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for choosing to do this podcast. I really appreciate your message and
your
effort.
Thanks. You know, little by little, I think we'll get there.
Absolutely, we will.
I want to thank Haley for her time and thoughts, and for her authentic perspectives on music community, the music industry, and the dream for a better musical world and what that could look like. I think a farmer's market sounds pretty apt. All the music you've heard on this episode are either from the Circuit de Zeux project or from Jackie Lynn, and used with Haley's permission. There's a link to her Bandcamp in the episode's description if you'd like to hear more. Today marks the end of season one of Community Matters. It's been an incredible opportunity to speak with brilliant musical minds about the importance of music community. Community does matter, it always has. But that importance, perhaps, has never been more apparent than in this moment, when a global pandemic has obliterated the live music industry, stealing musicians' primary source of income, and placing the futures of key supporting structures like music venues, promoters, managers, all in question. Still, those brilliant minds continue to create, readily sharing their art with the people that it speaks to. These creators have and continue to inform the community we're building at Grey Matter, and I want to thank each artist for their time and energy, as well as all the managers and PR folks who have helped to facilitate the conversations. Remember, we all have a vested interest in making sure our musicians can continue to make music. I also want to thank Alexander Frieden and Grace Rubin for their help in editing the podcast. Just one more example of the necessity of community. Community Matters is a production of Grey Matter, the music community where artists and listeners discover one another. We're building a farmer's market. And if you'd like to be part of it, feel free to follow us on Instagram or download the beta at our website, www.greymatter.fm. We'll be on the general app stores soon, where we'll be sharing and discovering music together while supporting the artists we love. You're all invited. We hope to see you there. And thank you for being here.